All right, everybody, welcome. I'll give you a quick heads up, and then we're going to get right to it. First hour today is the power hour. So any mechanical questions you've got, let's go ahead and get those lined up right now. Second hour will be general questions. So whether you want to be in on the first hour or the second, the sooner you press one, the better your chances of getting through. So press one, whether you've got a question for the first hour or the second. Usually the first hour goes pretty quick. So if you want a chance to get through, press one on your phone right now, and we will get to you. So here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. Today is the Power Hour. This is the show where we answer all of your mechanical questions, engines, ECMs, electronics, sensors, troubleshooting, fuel mileage, modifications, you name it. We'll talk about it here on the air. And because it's the Power Hour, I have some reinforcements helping me out from Pittsburgh Power today. We've got Bruce Mallinson and also joining me, John and Ethan. Hey, guys, welcome back.
Thank you, Kevin. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks, Kevin.
Great to be here.
Yeah, great to have you guys here. You know, throughout the week, you know, I'll get most mechanical questions. I can usually give some people some ideas on where to go, but I get those really tough ones, and I think, boy, I wish I had you three on with me. So here we are. We've got you here today, and we've got some calls and questions lining up already. But before we get to those, what's going on over at Pittsburgh Power these days? And John and Ethan, it looks like this is to you right now because
yep.
We just lost Bruce. We'll get him back. We'll get him back. But what's going on over there?
We just cured a smoky Detroit by changing some pistons. We got that done for a customer who ended up with a PK spec engine. I don't know if they call that a spec or a model, but the PK. Which uses a 15-to-1 piston, which yields only about 13.2-to-1 when you measure it all out, which is not nearly enough to get an efficient burn of diesel fuel. So we took that engine, and all we did was change the pistons and nothing else, and all of a sudden it doesn't smoke anymore, and it doesn't stink, and it works a whole lot better. We're about to put it on the dyno this afternoon and see what it did for horsepower. And we're also making some other changes to that. It's a D-Deck 3, which was never a it's in a glider. It was built to be a D-Deck 3, right? Or is it a D-Deck 4?
D-Deck 4.
It's a D-Deck 4? Okay. Regardless, but it was a pre-emission D-Deck 4. And we're retrofitting a VG turbo to it right now and doing our own programming on that rather than use the VG to create back pressure for EGR. We're going to use it to make a much broader band of torque as well as controlling the boost so we can ramp it up the way we want to and have the boost curve flatten out a little bit and carry on a little bit farther as well.
Wow.
We've
got Bruce back. I want to jump in there because there's two things I just love about that. One, the whole, you know, parts differences between the different builds starts to make so much sense now with these problem engines that we had where we couldn't get fuel mileage or they wouldn't run right. So I'm assuming that piston, even though it's the wrong one, it would be really difficult to know that. I'm sure it fits just fine. The engine goes back together. It starts and it runs. It just doesn't run right.
It looks identical. You can't tell the difference to the naked eye. The only difference is the difference, the height between the pin and the crown of the piston. So the 16.5 is just a tick taller than the 15. And if you measure it strictly in the bore, if you just measure the volume of the bore and divide the volume of the combustion chamber, which is in the top of the piston, they're both as advertised. But the effective compression ratio, after you add the losses in volume or the gains in volume from the gasket and then from the valve pockets, is when we come up with a real number. And we had to take and CC all of those parts and figure out what it was.
Wow, that's amazing and exciting. And then the other thing I love is, you know, we've kind of looked at the VG Turbo as a problem because it seems like we're always fighting with them and something's not working right. And, you know, I always thought, why don't we just go back to a nice, simple turbo? But you guys have now taken what was a problem and you're turning it into an advantage. I love that.
Yeah, there are a lot of advantages to it, to the VG Turbo. And with some of the control methods that we've taken, we don't have the thing sitting there screaming at idle anymore. And some of that stuff was what was taking life out of those turbos. We use it the way we want. It breathes nice and free at idle, and then when we call for boost, it tightens up a little bit to increase the turbo speed and creates more boost for us when we want it. And then we back it back off and use it like a wastegate later on. But that also allows the turbo to breathe a little freer. So it acts like a much larger turbo in that instance. So it's really, we've got a lot of advantages to it. And with the way we've mapped the programming for it, the durability should not be an issue. We're not stressing it in the same way the factory was whenever they installed them.
So tell me if I'm right here. You know, if we're looking at a plain, simple turbo, some of the things we used to do, try to look at the operation. Are you heavy? Are you light? Are you on the level more often? Are you pulling a lot of hills? And you used to try to pick the best turbo, and sometimes it was just a compromise, right? But now with the VGT, aren't you just saying that you're able to just program that turbo to be the way you want it to be in each different situation?
Precisely. In the old days, Bruce used to have me hammering exhaust housings on and off of turbos till we got the combination that we wanted. Now we've got it all right there, and we just control it with the computer and with the programming. Quite often with a fixed geometry turbo, we'll tune to that turbo, and that's it. We'll run out of boost at some point, or we'll overspeed the turbo at some point and then create some heat or take durability out of the turbo. Or if it's too large, we'll have to feed it a whole lot of fuel to get it going, and the thing will be really strong up top, but it won't be so strong down below, and we'll have smoke issues and other things. With the VG, we cover it all.
Wow. Yeah, that's awesome. Hey, Bruce, I know we lost you there for a minute, but we've got you back now.
Yes.
All right. So it sounds like you guys have had an exciting week over there. I love that stuff.
Just about every day is pretty exciting here, Kevin.
I need to just come out there and hang out.
Yes, you do. We have an office for you. It's my last office left, and I can put your name on the door. We have hookups for your motorhome, so.
There you go.
Well, you need to get that motorhome over here anyway so we can crank it up for you.
I do. I know. I've got to figure that out. We're 90% sure we're heading east when we leave here. So I know we're going back to Ohio, and then I've got to get back out to Oregon. I have finals in June, and then I'll be flying back out to Ohio. So maybe we'll figure out a way to make this work.
Well, just leave your motorhome here instead of Ohio because we're only 40 miles away, and it'll be ready when you get back.
Yeah, I thought about that, but Lisa's going to be, while I'm going out to Oregon, Lisa's going to be staying there with so she can visit some family, and she's going to be staying in the RV. But we'll figure something out.
Okay.
All right. So anything else, or do we want to jump into some phone calls?
Oh, we have some other things going on, but right now it's a little premature to mention them. Let's wait until we get some more results.
Got it. Maybe we can release some of the big stuff at the CMC. It's coming up here pretty quick, you know.
Yeah, I know. Week and a half.
Yeah, I know. I'm excited and terrified all at the same time.
You're going to have four of us on stage this time instead of just two of us.
Wow, that's
so
good.
So make sure you have four mics for us.
You know, that is my – this week I'm still working on a lot of my material. I have some new stuff this year. And then next week I've got to get in there and figure out all the AV and the audio and all that stuff. So I'll make sure we have everything we need.
Okay.
All right. So let's get to some phone calls. Let's start off in Oklahoma. Pedro, welcome to the program.
Hi, guys. I've got a 05, your favorite engine, Kevin, 05 Mercedes-Benz.
Oh, boy. I'm sorry.
No, I'm trying to install a oil bypass filtration system. It's not the OPF. It's the AMSOIL version. And I need to know where to install the oil pressure line. Where on the block or the head or the oil cooler? Where do you guys recommend I install it?
Usually on the passenger side of the engine, there's a main oil rifle. And you may see some plugs in the block.
Oh, I have.
Okay. And if you want to, put an oil pressure gauge in there and start it up. Or you could do it the dirty way. Have somebody else start it, and you'd be standing up in the front of the truck and see if the oil shoots out of there about 30 feet. And oil will, if you're on the main rifle, oil will travel about 30 feet.
Oh, wow. Well, good deal. Well, thank you, guys. She's working good so far. I'm getting 6.6 out of her. And thank God the ECR or the ECR cooler has not failed yet. Knocking on wood.
Well, put one of our manifolds on it and gives you another half mile of the gallon and 40 more horsepower.
That's coming next, I promise you. It will be coming next.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. You're welcome. All right. There's
hey,
the
Kevin.
Music that means, yeah.
The restriction in that manifold is the size of a quarter. So cylinders 4, 5, and 6 have to exhaust through the size of a 25-cent piece.
No wonder why that engine's such a dog. That and probably a couple other reasons. But it can be fixed. We'll talk about that and much more when we get back. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rothberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is the Power Hour. I've got Bruce and John and Ethan helping me out today. We're going to get back to some phone calls. We're off to Connecticut. Judd, welcome to the program.
Hello. I've got a question about a Detroit. Hello?
Hello.
Yes.
Okay.
What,
go ahead.
What year?
I have a question about Detroit horsepower per pound of boost. I think that is something that Bruce or somebody might know about.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, back along, there was a rate of horsepower per pound of boost, and I remember you folks said something about that on a previous show probably months ago or so. I was wondering if you could tell me what that rating was for Detroit 60 series.
Yeah, you got to tell me which Detroit.
Oh, it's a Series 3, D-deck 3,
D-deck 3,
7.
Did you,
470
did you say it was an 07?
No. It's a 365 horse D-deck 3.
Okay. 16.6 horsepower per pound.
16.6. Okay.
Now, what I want you to keep in mind, if you're going along the level and you're using 8 pounds of boost, you're probably at about 25 horsepower per pound. So, or let's say you're at 10 pounds and it's about 25 horsepower per pound. It's an exponential curve. It kind of tapers off at the top. So you make more at the bottom side. So what I want you to keep in mind, if you're riding along and you're just bucking the headwind, and let's say you're using 12 or 14 pounds of boost and you drop a half a gear and you can get that down to 8 and you just saved 6 pounds, you've saved about 120 to 150 horsepower. That's how critical it is not to use power to buck the wind on the level, but the better off to use gears. Let the truck slow down 3-4 mile per hour, bring the RPM up another 100, 150, and back out of the throttle.
Gotcha. I've got a, along that same note, I'm wondering if there's a boost sensor going bad in my engine. I've noticed a drop in boost pressure when I'm pulling a hill.
Well, what we do, if your truck was in here, we pressure test the whole intake system of every truck. The turbo, the piping going to the charge air cooler, the charge air cooler, the piping to the intake and the air compressor. Chances are you've got a leak, so you need to pressurize the entire system or do the smoke test.
Gotcha.
How many pound of boost are you down?
27, 28 pounds under a good load and everything working just about right. And lately it's anywhere from 20 to 25.
Yep, you got to find the leak. Now, do you have a million miles on your injectors?
Oh, that's a good possibility. I'm the fourth owner of the truck.
Fourth owner of the truck, and if it's a million miles or anything over 800,000 on the injectors, we find you lose power. And when you lose power, you lose boost. So if you don't have a boost leak, you need a set of injectors.
Probably at the 800,000-pound mark. The speedometer was changed once in this truck. It's approximately 800,000 on it now. So.
Okay.
Do for some love inside the engine, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
You got to give it some love.
There you
All
go.
All right, appreciate your help. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's head off to California. Dave, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, I'm watching your video on course of action, and I'm watching this part about how to buy a truck and going through the three inspections. And I'm just wondering, are the salespeople, are they really going to let you take their truck off the yard without buying it and do those three inspections? Is that real?
It depends on a couple things. One, how serious you are. And if you're a qualified buyer and you show them that, and two, how much they want to sell a truck. And for me, this is part of what I talk about when I talk about the hard work. Some people will look at that and go, oh, you know, I tried that and the dealer wouldn't let me take it. Yeah, you tried once. So screw that dealer. Move on to another one. And if they tell you no, then move on to another one. There's a lot of trucks for sale. And I will find somebody who will let me take that truck for a day or a couple hours or whatever I need and go do the inspections that I think are important. Bruce, if somebody brought you a truck, let's say an older pre-emission truck, and they wanted to know what kind of condition the engine was in specifically, that's one of the – how long would it take you guys to do that?
Oh, we'd probably have it here 2.5-3 hours.
Yeah. So, and they can, you can tell a lot about that engine and make a good recommendation to somebody as to what kind of condition it's in, what it may need in the next year or so. And if a dealer isn't going to let you go do that, then I'm going to find another dealer.
Hey, Kevin, Ethan and Leroy now with their computer programming can tell you about how many miles are on your injectors.
Wow.
By the horsepower that it'll put out as to the setting they put into the injector. How about that one?
That's amazing.
Learned that this week. That
is great information. And that's what we need when we're buying any truck, but especially when we're buying an older, high-mileage, pre-emission truck, which is what I want. I want as much information as I can get.
Okay. So the first inspection, I know the second one is front end shop, and then the third one is bumper to mud flap. What was the first one again?
Engine. And that's the most critical. You know,
if I
can only do one of these three inspections, you know, some of that stuff when I wrote it, it was back before before emission engines. So I was looking at buying used trucks that might have been in the $40,000 to $60,000 range. And I'd be willing to go spend the money and the time to do all three if I'm going to invest $60,000. If I'm looking at one of these older pre-emission trucks, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, I may not do all three to the same extent I talk about in that book, but the one I'm not going to skip is the engine. If I can only do one, that's the one I'm going to go do.
Okay, great. Awesome. All right, thank you.
Thanks for the call. You know, and the other thing, Bruce, I know you guys focus primarily on engines, and you can tell us so much stuff. But if somebody could get you that truck, you know, if they're willing to pay for your time, your shop could also just look at the truck overall and give them some ideas about what's going on, right?
We have a fellow, his name's Adam. He's 52 years old, been a mechanic his entire life. He walks around a truck and he just points out all the little problems that everybody else misses.
Yeah, that's the kind of stuff I'm talking about. So when you go into this, you know what you're getting into. And more important, I tell people, look, I don't care how many problems we come up with on the truck. Problems can all be fixed. I want to know what they are. For one, I can use them as negotiation points in the price. If I go back to a dealer and I've got a list of all this stuff that's wrong and needs fixed, that's just negotiation power. And
sure.
Then I also have a plan for what I'm going to do, what needs to be done before I put the truck on the road, what can wait a little while. You know, so before you ever even own the truck, you know more about it and you have a plan on what you're going to do with it, and you have some power to negotiate a better price.
That's correct. And if you can find yourself a nice, clean Kenworth or Pete with the Bridge Cat, the MBN, you have more negotiation power because that was the bad cat engine until we figured out how to make it a great engine.
Yeah. So again, you've turned a negative, an engine that a lot of people still don't want, into a positive. You can pick it up cheap because you know how to fix it. Love that.
That's
stuff.
Correct.
Let's head off to Indianapolis. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Hey, Bruce. How y'all doing?
Good.
Good.
I'm glad to hear. Appreciate the show as always. You guys do a great job.
Thank you.
Well, Kevin, I talked to you a couple weeks ago about ordering this glider from Kenworth, looking at a T660 with a studio sleeper, and I called you about the rear gear questions and what gears you would prefer, and I can't seem to get a definitive answer from the salesman at two different dealerships, and you know I think I'm crazy wanting to go with like even a 293 rear axle ratio. You know, they're saying, oh, well, we'll even be able to get the truck moving, you know, with a heavy load. And I've been trying to explain to them, you know, how we run it in 11s with a 13-speed transmission in direct and then have the two overdrives. And basically I'm calling. I got a few questions about that. And then also about the engines you guys were talking about earlier, the PK engines and the engines that aren't built for the truck.
Hold that thought. We've got to get to a break. We'll come back and we'll talk about that right after this. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is the Power Hour. We've got Bruce and John and Ethan with us here today, and we're taking your calls and answering your questions. Bruce, we're going to get back to Mike here. How long have you been talking about and recommending setting up trucks to run in a direct gear, which means you probably are going to have a gear ratio, a rear-end gear ratio, somewhere under 3, like a 264, a 279, a 293. How long have you been talking about that?
My first one was a Peterbilt, and the guy lived on Martha's Vineyard, and it had a twin-turbo 475 Cummins, And in those engines, we ran between 1,700 and 21, and I had them put a 308 gear ratio in to run in direct. And that was about 1987.
Yeah.
Now,
so
whenever they say, when a truck dealer says, well, you can't start out, well, how does J.B. Hunt, Swift, and Schneider teach people that never drove a truck how to start out with 264s? When a seasoned owner-operator like the people listening to this show, they will have no problems doing it.
None. And it amazes me that still to this day you have somebody trying to sell a truck that should know a little more than that. One thing that people have to think about, how often do we really start out a truck in low gear? Most of the time you don't. You start off in second, a lot of times third. So if you've got that higher gear ratio, the lower number, just start off in a lower gear, and that makes up for all of that.
One gear lower. Instead of third, use second. If you use second, use first. It's not rocket scientist. Now, he mentioned 293. That, to me, is a little bit high.
You know,
I mean, a little bit low because
that's
not going to give him much cruising speed in direct at 58 to 62.
You know, if I remember right, he'll refresh my memory. I think the problem was that Kenworth is telling him they can't get him a gear ratio any higher than that. That, you know, we were talking about maybe the 279s or 281s, and he is going to run fairly slow, and then you do have the other two gears when you need to go faster.
Order the glider kit without differentials, and let's put differentials under it.
That's another idea.
Well,
yeah.
Kevin, you know, talked about that, and, you know, I didn't know if that turned to be a huge hassle, you know, to find the rear ends, and I wasn't sure if they'd be, you know, warrantied and whatnot. And so, like I said, those guys at Kenworth are, you know, they said the same exact thing about starting off. I told them, I said, I run this 13-speed in this Volvo with 342s. I never use low gear in it, you know, and I'd have that. And I told them, you know, Schneider built however many of their trucks with the 10 speeds and the 264 gears. And, you know, I see them going up and down the road, and they seem to be doing okay. And, you know, I want to get into this this new truck. You know, I've got almost $1.4 million on this old Volvo. And, you know, it's just if I can't get the gear ratio right, it's going to be bugging me. And, you know, so Bruce, are you still doing only high-end gliders, or can you?
No. We'll build anything you want, but all I have to do is make one phone call, and I'll have your differentials here with the right gear ratio, the right suspension, everything rebuilt with a nationwide warranty.
Well, that sounds like it might be a pretty good deal right there. And are you building gliders with the Series 60 Detroits, or are you building the N14 and Cats?
No, heavens no. Most of the ones we built had the 60 series, and the engine that we'll be assembling at the CMC is still for sale, and that would be a great glider engine, and you can even help put it together if you're going to be there.
Okay, and basically the Series 60 that you guys were talking about earlier in the show, and I keep hearing the horror stories about the marine parts in them and the PK motor, and how can you tell from the engine serial number if it's not the correct application?
Yes, right on the data tag, it'll say PK, MK, or BK. You only want the BK. You don't want the MK or the PK.
Okay, sounds good. Well, I'll definitely be in touch with you, Bruce. I appreciate it because, like I said, it's been giving me anxiety attacks thinking about it. And I
don't
want to be stuck in the truck with the rubber.
Let us just do this for you. We can the rear end. I've done some research with the transmissions, and there are some transmissions available with a lower reverse gear and lower low as well. So we can solve the gear issue without any problems at all. We've also got some metal treatments we'd like to try in some rear ends and transmissions as well that I'd like to do something with. So you really ought to give us a ring about the engine and the driveline for this build.
And when he says treatment, he's not talking about an oil additive. He's talking about putting dimples in the gears, the golf ball type dimples, but they're microscopic to hold the grease better.
Ah, interesting. What a great opportunity for somebody to come to the CMC, hands-on, be a part of building that engine, and then put it into a really amazing glider.
Kevin, if you have your hands on and you're putting pistons down in the bore and you're torquing your rod bearing caps and main bearing caps, what do you think your attitude when you're pulling a hill is going to be? You're going to be thinking about everything that's going on inside that engine, and you're going to be a little bit lighter on the throttle.
I'm smiling just thinking about it. What a great opportunity.
Maybe we'll let you do some of the work.
There you go. We'll see if I can sneak off the stage once in a while to go do that.
We'll make that happen.
There you go. Let's go to Virginia. Clint, welcome to the program.
Kevin, how's it going?
Good.
I have a question for Bruce. Unfortunately, the only time I've ever made it out to his shop was when I was picking up an engine block for my carrier that I was working. But
where do
my
you...
question...
Go ahead.
The carrier was out of New Oxford, Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay.
My question for you is about the... I have a 2005 T600 with the C15 Acer MXS engine. I was wondering what kind of boost this should be producing.
What horsepower is it?
475.
475 makes 38 pounds.
All right. And you may have solved this problem already with an earlier call, because it was peaking at about 23 pounds, and then they pulled the turbos apart and found out that they were in not so good shape, so we replaced those. But it's still only peaking about 27 pounds.
Oh, my. You better get... Where do you live?
I live down in New Oxford area.
Oh, well, you're close. You need
yeah.
to bobtail that truck over here, and let's fix that. You'll be here for a day, and let's get it up to about 48 to 52 pounds, and that'll run right.
All right. And that reading is coming from the Caterpillar computer that they put on the dash, and I have not verified whether that's actually right yet or not.
How many miles are on this?
It's got almost 1.3 on it right now.
Has it ever been overhauled there?
No.
Okay, and to your knowledge, are the injectors original?
As far as I know, they are.
Because Cat injectors are they're number one for losing the torque, horsepower, and boost when over time, especially over 800,000 miles.
Right. That's why I said you may have solved it already, because the earlier call talked about the same thing.
Yeah, and I've seen it, dozens of times now. I mean, it's one of the first things I start asking the guy, how many miles are on it and what's the history?
Yeah, it's now the first thing we ask when we're struggling for power.
Now, being we solved your problem, we'd like to have your work.
Well, I'm saving up to hopefully bring it out to you guys to rebuild it.
Okay, well, then we can really do some magic.
Right. My question then would be, do you think it's worth putting a new set of injectors in based on the mileage, or just kind of waiting it out till I get the overhaul done?
No, if you're not having high oil consumption, let's get it in here and set the ECM properly and put a new set of injectors in.
Yeah, because I might put a gallon in between 30,000 oil changes if I'm running
wow.
it hard. If I'm not running it hard, it doesn't really use any.
Wow.
Now, let's get the horsepower on up to 550, 600 where it should be, so you can get some fuel mileage. And then it's easier to save money when you have fuel mileage, because you're... Yeah, or horsepower up. That way you get the fuel mileage. Then you can save the money for the rebuild.
Right. All right. I'll try to give you guys a call here soon.
All right. Sounds good. There's the music. I've got to get to a break. Don't go away. We'll be right back with more stuff. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Thank you. right, so a quick heads up. We're heading into the fourth segment here, and we'll get to as many questions as we can. But at the end, when I say goodnight, goodbye, all that stuff, don't hang up, because we'll come back and we'll do another hour of general questions. So here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is the Power Hour. We're heading into the final segment, so I'm going to get right back to the calls and see how many we can knock out here. I've got John and Bruce and Ethan helping me out, and we're going to head off to Indiana this time. Dexter, welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going today?
Good. What can we help you with?
All right, I got a 07 Mac with 1.2 million, just under 1.2 million miles on it. Never been rebuilt. And went to price a crankshaft dampener at Mac because you guys keep talking about changing the dampener, and it's never been changed. And I started having exhaust brackets break and some fittings backing off of the engine block, and all I've had to do is tighten those up and they're fine, and then they start to back off again. So I was like, yeah, look more into this. And they don't really want to sell you one.
Oh.
They don't stock it, and they say they never sold it, and they really don't suggest pulling it off. And I was like, well, that's not the answer I'm looking for. But I was wondering if you guys think that's a good answer to keep and just walk away, but I think I know the answer to that one.
Absolutely not. The filler inside of those hardens up over time, and heat cycles tend to harden it up, and you no longer have a damper. It's just a weight hanging around the front of there. So Bruce just ran out of the office here to go to the parts department to get you a price on the Mac damper. So he'll be back here in a minute with a price for you, but that was definitely not the answer that you should have got from your dealer there.
And other thing, have you ever, have the engine mounts ever been checked on that?
Yes, actually, just recently. Okay. I had it in a shop for a little bit of work when I was out in Pennsylvania, and I had them check that just to make sure.
Okay, that's good.
Those dampers, that's cheap insurance. I think the most expensive one you have is $700 or something, and every half a million, that's really not much. So that's a... That's a maintenance item.
Yeah, exactly.
That
and
makes
I've, like
a
I
whole
said,
lot of sense.
I've got 1.2 million miles on this engine, and it's like it's only using a gallon about every 10,000. Used to about every 25,000 I'd put a gallon in. But, I mean, it's starting to wear in a little bit now. But it's like, well, that might save me even longer. Maybe I can get 1.5 out of it.
Sure, why not?
And, you know, this is an EGR engine. And really, I put one turbo on it. Other than that, it's been a great running engine. But it's awful small. And I know Kevin talks about not using the 11 liters for real heavy stuff. I've grossed 130,000 with this 11 liter Mac.
Wow.
And it does pretty good. I got 355s, 13 speed. But I try, if I'm real heavy, I run it in direct and just get down around 1550 on RPMs, and I'll just stay there. I don't care how slow it is. And then if I'm running up around 90,000 or 100,000, I'll run it in single over and run 60 mile an hour or 61.
That's
but,
impressive.
I've been real impressed with it, but then I keep hearing some pretty crazy nightmares with the newer Mac engines. Now they got the SCR on them and all that. So.
Wow. Okay. Well, Bruce is not at that price for you.
Yeah.
The price, there's three different dampers, so we'd have to have the engine number, but the most expensive one is $591.
Oh, wow. Well, that's good. And you guys will do that there.
Sure, we'd install that for you.
All right. It's an MP7 Mac engine. And now, do you guys do anything else to them?
We can build you a manifold, exhaust manifold.
Oh, that'd be awesome, because that's one thing. I've replaced the exhaust manifold more than I've replaced the turbo, so I've replaced the exhaust manifold three times.
and the turbo all at once.
Wow. And then we can also, do you have an exhaust gas temperature gauge?
Yes, I do.
Okay. And you have a turbo boost gauge, correct?
Yes, I do.
And we could put our muffler on it and or the fast
fuel system. I have
your
muffler.
Okay.
I do have your muffler. I put it on about a year, maybe 2 years ago.
Okay. I did a radiator once for a guy with a Mack that ran over the Rocky Mountains. And he told me he gained 15 mile per hour. I said, I didn't give you any more fuel. How'd you gain 15 mile per hour? He said, I don't have to back out of the throttle now like I used to.
Oh, I can tell you, she gets hot. I took the load that I hauled, that was 130,000. I went from North Carolina to Northwest British Columbia. And with 11-liter engine, you're working that sucker hard. And it gets hot.
Okay.
Yeah. Hey, great stuff. Let's try to get to a couple more calls here before we've got to wrap it up. We're off to Vermont this time. Jim, it's your turn.
Yeah, how you doing? Hey, I got an electrical quiz for you. I've got a Volvo with a Cummins engine, and the Volvo's got the readout up there by the gauges, and that thing will be flickering on me, the readout, and I put her over into the voltage, and I also got a voltage readout with the inverter in the sleeper, and it'll be fluctuating like crazy. It'll get real radical. It go clear up to 14.6 and drop down to 13.8 and everywhere in between.
Well, that would explain the flickering there, but something is drawing a whole bunch of current on and off. You don't happen to hear any like relays clicking or breakers that are turning on and off whenever this is happening?
No, I sure don't.
Something's drawn off, you know, the current, and then when the current gets high and low, it's turning it on and off very fast by the sounds of it.
Would a regulator and an alternator do it if it started failing?
It could.
It definitely could.
Okay. How about a short in a battery, maybe?
Possibly, but you can check the alternator pretty easily. If you can get it to do it at idle, you know, just run out with I'd use a multimeter and then see if it's doing it at the alternator. And if it is, then you know where your problem lies.
Yeah, like right now it's not doing it at all. It's intermittent, probably because it knows I'm talking about it. But it just gets really, really radical. It'll even do it while you're idling, just by the shaking of the truck from the idle.
Yeah, and that's when you're going to want to test it.
Yeah, okay. Well, I appreciate it.
To Illinois. Joe, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I have a 05 BSX code cat motor, and I'm curious as to what you can do with the ECM to give me some more power and hopefully better fuel economy.
What is it currently set to?
Factory setting is 435.
Okay, we can turn that one up to 550, 1850 torque. Should be pretty close to that at the wheels. And that'll get it going much better than what it was.
I should certainly hope so. And that's one of those, send it to you, y'all have it for a day, and basically send it right back. Sort of
at the moment, it'd be a couple days, but yeah, we can do that one through the mail.
Okay. I also have an issue where it got replaced about 6 months ago, and ever since then, it has said it has a personality conflict with my chassis computer. Can y'all make that go away?
Quite possibly. I'd have to look at the code, and I could give you a better answer at that.
Is it possible to bring the truck to our shop?
It is conceivable, yes.
That's always the best way.
Okay. I'll see what I can do about getting a load out there.
Okay. Where is home?
Oklahoma.
Okay. If you could get a load this way, and then we could see why it doesn't want to talk to the chassis. It's much better to do it that way and then try to do it through the mail.
Okay. outstanding. I appreciate the information, gentlemen. Have a great day.
Okay.
All right, great stuff. Hey, that's going to do it. We really don't have enough time to do justice to another question. Anything you guys want to close with this week?
Well, looking forward to the CMC and looking forward to building an engine there, and hopefully we have somebody that would like to help build their own engine. But all good stuff. Everything's great. Shop is full.
I'll tell you, you know, the CMC, we're noticing a different pattern this year that I'm very happy with. In the past years, we know that in those last couple of weeks, we're going to get some cancellations. Some guys who want to be there, they can't get a load set up. Something went wrong with their truck. It happens. This year, though, signups are still strong. And I think we just sent over the list to print name tags. 399 people. And
wow.
Today we had four more signups. So pretty exciting to see that it is still growing. Hey, thanks, you guys, as always. We'll see you again next week. I've got to get out of here. This has been the Power Hour. We'll do it again next week. Be safe. Be profitable. Be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, everybody, we're going to get on a second hour. As we go along, I'll let you know what the question volume is like and if there's a chance to get in. Here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs.
Back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers. The list goes on and on. You've got a question about anything at all, pick up the phone, give me a call. We'll tackle it here on this show. And I'm going to get to the calls here. I don't want to take up too much time because these one-hour shows during the week just fly by. I do want to give you a quick update on the CMC. We are right at around 400 people that are going to be in the room this year. That is a huge increase over last year. I'm very excited about that. The good news this year is that we still have room. In the past, the reason we only had 225 people was that's all we could fit. And this year we've moved. We're in Council Bluffs, Iowa. If you haven't heard, the CMC is coming up in just about a week, a little over a week, May 16th through the 20th. Still time to get signed up. We do still offer the payment plan option. I'll finance this for you. We don't do any credit checks. We just trust you. And here's the beauty of doing the CMC on the payment plan. If you sign up right now, it's going to cost you right around $100. We do charge a little bit of interest. It's $8 or $10 a month. But if you sign up right now, you're only going to make one payment. And you get to come to the CMC and get the benefit of all the information. It's a week jam-packed full of stuff. And after that, you're going to be making and keeping so much more money with everything you learn that you won't even notice the payment. It's kind of like getting to come for free. So if you've ever thought about coming to the CMC, now is the time. You can sign up two ways. You can go to the website, letstruck.com, and look under the events tab, or you can call us. We'll answer all your questions. We'll tell you what's going on, and we'll get you signed up. 855-800-FUEL. 855-800-3835. I'm so excited because even this close to the event, signups are actually getting stronger every day. I love that. We have something for everybody this year, whether you're brand new to the industry or you're running a small fleet. And of the people who are coming, we have a really good mix of all of those and everybody in between. So come out and join me in Council Bluffs. I'd love to see you. Let's go to Massachusetts to get started tonight. Everson, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. I just wanted to go over my last oil sample results and let me know what's going on.
Yeah, everything looks really good. If we look at the important stuff, no fuel dilution, very, very low soot, nothing to worry about there. Viscosity is about perfect. Base is holding up, no oxidation, no nitration. Wear metals are low. They flagged it for tin, but it's only a 2. And
okay.
I'm almost wondering where the tin even came from, because I do see a tiny little bit of copper, but this is so low. I would not be concerned about it at all. That is just a trace, and you've got quite a few miles on this oil. Other than that, they flagged the magnesium. But you can ignore the magnesium completely because that's just an additive that's in the oil, and it's not unusual to see the numbers all over the board. You could take 2 gallons of oil, identical oil, right off the shelf and test them, and many times they'll have very different numbers on the additives. So in all the years I've been looking at oil samples, I've never seen those additive metals matter.
At what point do I need to be thinking about changing the oil? Should I just keep going as high as I can?
Or? Oh, yeah. Absolutely. You've got 140,000 miles on this oil, and it looks amazing. That's the beauty of a bypass filter and doing samples. You know, if you're at a level 1 or 2, we almost never change the oil at a level 1 or 2. So 0,
okay.
1, or 2, we almost never change the oil, unless I see something really odd in there. Level 3 doesn't necessarily mean we'll change it. We may look at things and keep an eye on them. Level 4 almost always means we need to change the oil and you know, kind of reset things. So you're still at a 1. You may get 300,000 miles out of this oil.
Great. And oxidation, what point is the concern?
Here's the interesting thing about oxidation. Oxidation in and of itself doesn't hurt anything. It's an indication that something else might be going on that we need to look at, excessive blow-by, something like that. So very seldom do we change oil because the oxidation's too high. It usually points us somewhere else, and we're changing it for some other reason. And you're just nowhere near that level on this one.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Kevin. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's head off to Jeremy in Ohio this time. Jeremy, it's your turn.
Hey, how's it going today, Kevin?
Good. What can I help you with?
Yeah, I had a question. I just started trucking here as of December. Got a rig from a buddy of mine. I leased on with a company and doing pretty well. And where I'm from in Pennsylvania, I have an opportunity for a friend who needs a lot of hauling done and looking to possibly get a couple trucks and start a business. I wanted to get some recommendation. This is all new to me, and wanted to see kind of where you recommended me start. I'm new to you as well. This is like my second week listening to you. Met another trucker who's been listening to you for years. So just starting out with some recommendations on where to go.
Oh, well, first off, thanks to the driver that recommended my show. I always appreciate that, and thanks for listening. What's your background? If you're new to trucking, what were you doing prior to coming into trucking?
I had a construction company for 7 years.
So you have business experience then?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so that's a big thing. I'm not so worried about the trucking experience. I think having a good, solid business foundation is far more important. We learn the trucking side, but it's the business side that's going to make you successful. So you've got a good foundation. Had you not had any real business background and you were pretty new to the trucking industry, I would have been really cautious about having tried to grow a company that aggressive. But I think you're probably in a good position. The first thing I would say is, do you have a good accounting system right now that shows you what's going on with the truck you have?
No, sir.
That's step number one. I would really get the numbers down, because the last thing we want to do is take an operation that isn't all that profitable right now. And without the numbers, we're just guessing. You know, it may feel like you're doing great, but without the numbers, we can't see the real truth and what the trends are going to be. So your main focus right now should be getting those numbers and then looking how are things going, and then we can start applying that to this new opportunity and seeing,
okay,
is there going to be enough profit to, one, to be able to afford to keep drivers, because drivers will be your single biggest challenge when you try to grow multiple trucks. This opportunity, tell me a little bit about the operation. Is it local, regional, over the road? How often does somebody get home?
Well, it's about a 450-mile run one way, and it's hauling new wall systems. It's from Pennsylvania down to North Carolina. And so it's a straight run. Don't have anything set in stone yet as far as reloads or working on anything down that way yet. But a friend of mine, he used to build log homes, got into this other industry, and now there's a several million dollar payout on his end and needing these walls transported. And so the opportunity is kind of fell into my lap, and so the business aspect is way more important for me to try and understand and make sure I'm doing that right before I get, doing anything else.
Yeah, well, hold that thought. Let me get to a break. We'll come back and we'll talk about this. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're going to get back to the calls. I was talking with Jeremy in Ohio. So, Jeremy, I see this as potentially being a really great opportunity because, as I said earlier, one of the biggest challenges in owning multiple trucks is drivers. The industry average turnover is about 100%. Drivers are pretty fickle at times, and they know they quit one job this morning and probably have another job after lunch. And because of that, they tend to jump around a lot. The easiest way I have found to solve that problem is get them home a lot. In my operation, when I ran multiple trucks,
I had set up runs that got drivers home every night, and I had zero turnover in an industry that averages 100%. So I would be doing two things. One, like I said, you've got to get some numbers on paper for this. You know, that's something we can help you with. We have the software. That's an easy problem to overcome. You've just got to do it. The next one is I would be working hard to build freight coming right back to where you are. I wouldn't try building. Now, I may expand out to some sort of a triangle if I needed to, where maybe we go, you know, one way down, another way out, and then another way back, if that's necessary. But I would look at just doing an out and back first. And there's two ways you could approach this. Depending on how much time you have and how much time you want to devote, you could go down to that area and go looking for direct customers yourself. It can be difficult, but it's not impossible. But then you also have to remember that not only will you have to find those customers, but you're going to have to service them. And that may take a lot of time. You may be better off staying put where you are, focusing on your end, and going down and partnering with a broker down in that area. And you could even arrange almost an agent kind of setup where you negotiate a flat rate. They get 8% of every load they put on your truck, and you only want loads coming right back to where you are. And let them go find the freight. They have the contacts. They can service those contacts down there, and you can stay on your end and make sure you're taking care of the most important freight, which is the stuff going out.
Gotcha. Do you guys have networks of brokers in that area? Or how would I get in contact with them?
You know, we don't necessarily have networks. One of the things we're doing here at the CMC at our big conference coming up in a couple weeks is we're actually bringing in some brokers to do a panel and help teach owner-operators and small carriers how to build those relationships, how to find a good broker, how to negotiate a good arrangement that works for everybody. But we don't necessarily have, you know, any kind of a network like that. But I think you've got a great opportunity here. If you do this right, I think you could build a really nice company and, like I say, overcome some of those biggest problems, which are keeping drivers in the seat.
Now, that CMC, is that something – I've heard you talk about the amount of people coming out. Is there any – one-on-one time with some people to really kind of help me crunch on some numbers to get this thing figured out so
yeah,
I can be the best at it?
I'm glad you asked that because it's something I haven't talked about yet, and this is a good opportunity. So we have, if I remember right, I just saw this list. I think we have 6 or 7 different opportunities to do one-on-ones. So, you know, talking about the numbers that I just talked about, you will be able to sit down with our accounting team and do one-on-one sessions on getting your numbers together. As far as running a trucking company, we have 2 different opportunities. We have Chuck Snow, who is the CEO of Traffics in Canada, a very successful trucking company and brokerage. And Chuck has agreed to do one-on-one with people. And these are free, no charge. So Chuck is one of the best resources I've ever seen for in the trenches, running a trucking company. They are the oldest brokerage in Canada. Well, a long history of success, so that's a great opportunity. Kenny Long, who is a relatively new small business owner-operator, he does our podcast called Trucking with Authority. Kenny's going to do one-on-ones. He's a great guy. How do you build this thing when you're still in one truck driving it? Because that's what Kenny's doing. We have, just trying to think, what we have George Gallimore doing one-on-one, or he's doing his negotiation and overdrive sessions, and that teaches people how to negotiate better deals. So those are all things that are outside of all the rest of the stuff we cram into the whole week. So, yeah, there's just never been this many resources in one place.
Awesome. Well, I will I'll go to the website and check it out, and you can look forward to my application coming out there to the EMC or MCC, whatever that is.
Yeah. CMC, Certified Master Contractor, and I think you've got an awesome opportunity here. I get excited about that kind of stuff, so I'd love to be able to help you and give you some resources that are going to make that successful, because I think that you're really on to something here. Let's go to Georgia. Richard, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin.
Got
a four sample.
Let's take a look at it and see what we've got here.
Got a 03 T600 Kenworth, 12-7 Detroit, and I just had an in-frame done at the first of the year. That's my first ore sample.
Got it. All right. So this is interesting here because I can see the history on this engine, and prior to doing the in-frame, it had some real issues. I mean, we had some horrible fuel dilution, a lot of soot, just all kinds of stuff, which is what we expect. That's what happens to an engine when it's worn out. And now we can see this oil sample after the in-frame, and things look much, much better. Your fuel dilution is at 2.8. That's virtually zero. I mean, it just the lab uses a really, really sensitive test now. So that's nothing. Your soot went from 3.7 down to 1.1. That is a huge improvement. And many times see, as this engine breaks in, that number may even get a little better, and it will get better after its first overhead, which I would recommend doing somewhere around 75 to 100,000 miles or so. Everything else looks fantastic. The wear metals are right where we would expect them to be. Nothing to worry about there. No trace of coolant at all. No dirt getting into the engine. So this looks really good.
All right. That's what I was wanting to check on you. And so everything looks like the engine went together pretty good, because I do have an issue with it. When I crank it up in the morning, it smokes just a little bit, like a little puff smoke coming out. And then after that, it just clears up, though, on that.
Yeah, it's the white, black, gray, blue. What kind of smoke we see?
Kind of a white color.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry about it. You know, this time of year when we get these changing temperatures, you know, where we might have a hot day and then a really cold night, that can build condensation up inside of an engine, and sometimes that's all it is. You're just burning off some of that condensation. Nothing in the oil sample to make me believe there's anything else going on. So keep doing what you're doing, and let's check the next sample. Let's head off to Chicago. John, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. First of all, I really enjoyed your freewheeling episode.
Oh, thank you.
I did,
too.
Not on the recordings, but that was a blast.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
And then fair tax now, because otherwise I wouldn't have this per diem question for you.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure I'm getting the short end of the stick on my per diem. My company pays me $175 a week in per diem.
Okay.
So that's, you know, $9,100 a year.
All right.
What I figure. But by my log books and my log report that I sent you in that review, I figure I should have gotten about $15,289.
Feeling like you're getting screwed, but let's explain this, because maybe not at all.
Okay.
Let's set per diem aside for a second, and let's talk about what I think is a more important number, and I'll ask you the question, and then I'll get to a break, and we'll come back and we'll talk about it. set the per diem aside, set taxes aside, set all that other stuff aside. My question is, are you happy with how much you've earned for the job you've done? Let's start there, and then we'll figure out the per diem side of it. And we'll do that right after this break. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. I'm going to go back to Chicago and talk to John. So, John, for the most part, I mean, we all would like to make more money, but are you pretty satisfied with the total amount of money you received?
I'm making it by, yeah.
Because the per diem doesn't really matter. And here's what I mean by that. They could take away the per diem completely, pay you the same total amount, and just make it all wages. But if they did that, then you would get taxed heavier. And so would they. So there is an advantage to getting paid per diem, but we don't have to get it that way, and we don't have to get it all. Anything they pay you in per diem saves you in tax. Now, you also get to potentially claim the rest of the per diem. So if you went in and figured out that, you know, you qualified for, say, $15,000 in per diem and they only paid you $9,000, if you can itemize, and that's I don't know that because I'm not looking at your tax return, you would still get to claim that $6,000 as a tax deduction as per diem.
So I would have had to itemize all my receipts for the year.
Correct. Yeah, and depending, and this is why I don't know, do you have mortgage interest, do you have real estate tax, do you have charitable contributions? I could go on and on and on. But if so, add $6,000 to that, and that may be what it takes to get you over the standard deduction, so then you could itemize. So it's not okay. That they didn't cheat you out of any money. From their point of view, there's only so much money they're going to pay you. And they're going to split it up between per diem and wage. So it's not like deserved that money and they didn't pay it to you. They just said, here's how much we're going to pay you for driving our truck. We're going to give you this much as a wage, so, and it's taxed. And we'll give you this much as per diem, and you won't have to pay the tax on it. So any amount of per diem, in my opinion, is a benefit. You know, if they could pay you all in per diem, still same dollar amount, then it'd almost be like having a fair tax in some ways because you wouldn't be paying Social Security and Medicare. And I mean, you can't do that. But it's not like you're being cheated out of anything. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it just looked like I was losing out on, you know, about $6,000. So I thought, you know, going through house remodels and everything right now, it would have been nice, but what do you do? Thank you very much.
Yeah, so you're welcome. I mean, here's the thing. Like I say, they are only going to pay you so much for your service. If they paid more in per diem, they would have paid less in wage. And that could be a little bit more of an advantage, but there's nothing wrong with the way they're doing this. Let's go to Chicago. Robert, welcome to the program.
Hello, Kevin. How are you?
Great. What's on your mind today?
Last week, you were talking with the driver who was thinking about the opening his own company, you know, getting authority and stuff. And you recommended him opening the company in a different state like South Carolina, Tennessee, or Florida. My buddy is in he wants to do the same kind of thing. And I told him about that. And he says that I'm wrong. If it would be that, you know, you could open the company in a different state, everybody would do that. Can you explain me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, and let me be clear, because maybe I wasn't last time. I don't want anybody to open a company in a state that they don't consider their residence. Now, what we consider our residence can be kind of slippery. There's no clear definition. You may, like, I'll give you an example. I had a house in Ohio, a house in Oregon, and my business was in Florida. Well, who is to say of those three states which one is my residence? There's no clear rule on that. So as long as my business was in Florida, which was a great state to have a business in, I just claimed my residence as Florida as well, and the other two places are vacation homes, rental properties, whatever I want to call them. What I wouldn't have done is claimed Oregon as my residence and Florida as my business. That gets complicated. Then I end up paying, you know, corporate fees to both Oregon and Florida, and I have to claim at being a foreign corporation. That gets complicated. So my advice to that person was pick one of those states that doesn't have a state income tax, because that's a huge advantage, and make that your resident state. Doesn't mean you have to live there full time, but make it your resident state and open your corporation in that state, because we save a lot of money on taxes. Does that make sense?
Yeah, okay. I got it. Thank you.
Yeah, but I don't want to live in one state, claim it as my residence, and then open a corporation in another state. That gets confusing and complicated and usually ends up costing me money. What I would do is find a way to make that state my home residence. Let's go to Pennsylvania. Bill, welcome to the program.
How are you doing today, sir?
Good. What can I help you with?
Yes, been listening for a long time, and I just and right now I'm in a process of saving money because I want to break the cycle of the lease operator deal and do it the right way here. How hard is it, or how difficult is it to, say, get an older truck? I've been looking at cab movers all of a sudden, and upgrading to the, whatever the engine was in there at the current moment to, say, a Detroit or a M14 or even a Cat, and the transmission to go behind it.
You know, anything's possible. I try to avoid putting a different engine in a truck than what it was built with, because it can, it's very hard to predict all the stuff that's going to need to be changed, and it can start to get really expensive. I'll give you one example. This was a truck Pittsburgh Power built. The truck was originally built with a 14-liter Detroit, but it was a 14-liter emission engine. They replaced it with the same 14-liter, except it was the non-emission version. Now, that's a pretty close swap. It ended up taking them almost 2 weeks longer than what they expected. And all of that time means lots of money. People have to get paid for their time. So they had to fabricate and find parts and modify. And that's virtually the same engine, just one emission and one non-emission. When you go from, say, a certain model of a Cat to a Detroit, we don't know everything that's going to have to get changed. Unless a shop has done the exact same truck with the exact two engines, which the odds of that are slim to none, it's just too hard to predict. So, of course, it can be done. I just don't like so many unknowns because they can get expensive. So I would prefer to look for that cab over with the engine I already want and either pull that engine out and do a complete out of frame on it and put it back in, maybe just do an in-frame on it, or if I had to, put another engine in, but I would want it to be the same engine. When we start changing models and engines, and you just run into a lot of stuff, and it ends up getting expensive.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Yeah, again, I know people are saying, oh, no, that's not true. I did. Yeah, I know you did it, and it happens all the time, and it can be done. But to me, it's a lot of risk. It's the risk of the unknown, and I don't see why – I don't see any good reason to take that risk. I would rather spend a little more time digging and finding that truck that already has the engine that I want. And like I said, if I have to put another one in, okay, but I'm going to put the same engine, same make and model, or I'm going to pull that one out and do a complete out of frame, which if I have that budget, that's what I'd really like to do, because then I get to build the engine exactly the way I want it, but it's going to bolt right back in. I'm not going to have to modify wiring harnesses. I'm not going to have to modify brackets and alternators and air conditioners and exhaust and intake and all kinds of other things, linkages and all kinds of things that can change when we're putting a different engine in than what it had originally. All right, so we are going to get to a break. When we get back, we'll get to more of your calls and questions. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, we are heading into the last segment, and I do have one more question that I'm going to get to, and then I could fill up the rest of the space myself, which is never a problem, or if you jump in right now and press 1, I could probably take another question or maybe 2, so it's up to you. Here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment. So many questions, so little time, but I'm going to get right back to it. Here we go. We're off to Utah this time. Douglas, welcome to the program.
Hello, Kevin.
What can I help you with tonight?
I'm looking at getting a truck, but I'm trying to figure out, is it better to go with a lease, lease purchase with a $1 buyout, so it'll be in my name. It's not going to be held within a company. Or should I get, if I can get the financing for, if I get an independent financing and I buy the truck outright, what's the biggest difference between them and what would be the better of the two routes? I mean, I think buying it with cash would be a lot better, but if you didn't do the lease purchase route, what's the advantage and disadvantage of doing that type of routing?
Got it. So I'm going to answer the question. I'm also going to point you to a resource where I wrote this all out. In a much longer answer with all the details and facts, and it's free. I wrote an ebook called Changing Lanes Without Crashing, and in the beginning, I compare all of the different ways to buy a truck. Use cash, borrow some money, lease from a third-party leasing company, lease from your carrier. I cover them all in a lot of detail. So if you go to the website, letstruck.com, and you sign up for the webinar, which is right there on the homepage, in the webinar, you'll see a link for a download on that document. You can download it free, and I also have it in audio so you can listen to it. But we'll cover it here because it's a good question. By far, the best way to buy a piece of equipment is cash. No question. It's simple. It's the least expensive because I don't have to pay to use somebody else's money. And it has the least amount of risk. one thing I heard you say that I want to clarify, because you said I might do a lease purchase with a dollar buyout and the truck would be in my name. The odds of that are slim to none. I've looked at a ton of lease purchase deals with a dollar buyout, with any kind of buyout. The title doesn't go in your name until you pay that last dollar. The rest of the time, the title's probably going to be in their name. That is the vast majority of lease purchase deals through the carrier, and that's the biggest reason I don't like them. You have no legal ownership of that vehicle until the end, and too many things can go wrong. So let's set that aside, and let's talk about the tax difference between leasing and buying, because this confuses a lot of people. They've heard over the years that leasing is better because you get to write off your whole payment. That's a half-truth. Yes, the truth is when you lease something for tax purposes, you do write off your whole payment. The part about it being better is the part that's not true. Let me give you an example. Let's say it's December and you're getting ready to acquire a truck and you're trying to decide, should I lease it or should I buy it? And let's just say that it's a $50,000 truck. And all we're talking about right now are tax. If you go and lease that truck, and let's say you have to put $5,000 down, and then you have to start making lease payments. Well, you're not going to make your first lease payment till January. The $5,000 that you put down is deductible, but you don't get to deduct it all at once. You have to divide it out over the term of the lease. So if it's a 36-month lease, you're only going to get 1/36 of $5,000 as a deduction this year, and you'll get nothing for payments because you didn't make any. Now, if I bought the truck, I could go in with the same deal, $5,000 down, finance the truck. I still have the same $5,000 out of pocket. I'm not going to make my first payment till January. But if I wanted to, I could deduct the entire $50,000 purchase on this year's tax return, because that's what depreciation allows me to do. No matter how we acquire the truck, we will get to deduct every dollar we have to spend to own that vehicle or to rent it. Doesn't matter. It's a matter of when we get to deduct it. On the lease, we don't have any options. We have to follow the rules and the schedule. But if I buy it, depreciation gives me all kinds of options. I can take it all up front. I can take a little bit up front. I can take any amount that I want up front and then spread the rest out over the rest of the three-year schedule. So there's no ultimate tax advantage to either one. We're going to get the same amount deducted. It's just a matter of when we deduct it, and I like having that control.
Okay. So as far as that, you know, even if it was leased through a third party, they still own the title, but once you pay the title off, then it becomes your truck then.
Well, not necessarily. So there were times in the past that I leased trucks, never from a carrier. I leased it from a leasing company, from a finance company. So I went out and spec'd a brand new truck, and then I used a leasing company to finance it. But the vehicle was put in my name with a lien against the title. That's not always the way it works. But even if, when we're dealing with a third-party company, the contract could be written so that even if my name isn't on the title, I have complete legal control of the vehicle as long as I make my payments. They have no legal ability to take that vehicle back away from me, even if my name isn't on the title, as long as the contract is written that way. All of these lease purchase deals through the carrier are not written that way. The whole point of them writing the lease is so that they can yank the vehicle back away from you anytime they want to. And they do.
Yeah, that's the way. I'm not going through my carrier or go through a carrier. I want to actually do for example,
well,
I know them, you know, something like them, you know, where they,
right. Well,
but not going through a carrier like those.
Here's what I want to make clear. No matter whether it's a carrier, a third-party leasing company, an independent finance company, a bank, none of that tells us anything. The only thing that tells us if we have the deal that we want is the contract itself. I know of lots of third-party leasing companies that are not carriers, and they will lease you a truck, but they also have the ability to come take it away. That's what we don't want. We want legal ownership of the vehicle. We don't want an overly restrictive contract. And I wish there was an easier way for me to say, but every contract is different. There's no such thing as a standard contract. We have to read and understand every word in the contract to know what it's saying.
Okay. Now, with the leases, there's a way to back out to see what the interest rate of those, because under the Fair Credit Reporting, I know they don't have to tell you the percentage rate, but there's supposed to be a way you can back, say if you purchase a truck for $50,000 and it end up being $60,000 over 2 years, there should be a way to backtrack
to
the interest rate of that.
Yeah, there are calculators all over the internet that you do that.
Okay. Sweet. Well, thanks a lot, Kevin.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Good question, by the way. Let's go to Illinois. Lloyd, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Thank you very much for taking my call. I've heard you talk in the past about fuel tax, and it can make a big impact on your bottom line. I'm actually a company driver, but I'm looking to help my boss out a little bit. I was wondering if there's some place that I can just go to a website and look up fuel tax per state to be able to figure out cheapest fuel prices.
There is. You can go to my website, letstruck.com.
Okay.
And then when you get there, you'll see the menu items across the top. The first one is gauges. The second one is services. The third one is solutions. And if you pull down that menu at the bottom of it, you'll see fuel price / tax. Click on that, and that shows you the fuel tax rate in every state. It also shows you today's average pump price in every state. It's updated every day. And then it even does the math and shows you the after-tax fuel price in every state.
Wow, that's awesome. That's a really good tool.
Yeah, so right there on our website, and you can't beat the price. It's free.
Okay. Since you answered that question really quick, can I ask you another one?
Sure.
I'm just looking for other ways to help my boss out. I know fuel is a big one. What else could I do as a company driver to help limit their exposure on expenses?
How big is the company? How many trucks?
Three trucks, four drivers, the fourth driver's in reserve. We all run dedicated routes.
Excellent. So there's the music, so I'm not going to have a ton of time on this, but I'll try to give you a couple ideas. The one thing to remember is you could introduce him to the Scan Gauge KR, because that may help all of his drivers save on fuel, so that's a great investment. The other thing to remember is every fuel-saving strategy you use in your driving also saves on maintenance. After that, I would say, treat his customers like they were yours and really provide value and service. That doesn't cut down on expenses, but it goes a long, long way. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time. Be safe, be profitable, be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. Kevin Rutherford. All right, everybody, thanks, and we'll see you back here tomorrow. I will continue on with my NTP series, and then we'll answer your health-related or general questions tomorrow. Thanks.